Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host a conversation with an individual whose inner journey inspires us and whose work is transforming our world in large and small ways. Awaken Calls are an all-volunteer-run offering of ServiceSpace, a global platform founded on the simple principle that by changing ourselves, we change the world to create a more compassionate and service-oriented society. Thank you for joining us.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. My name is Amit Dhingrani, and I'm really excited to be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. Today, our special guest speaker is Phil Kass. In a few minutes, our moderator, Richard Whitaker, will begin by engaging in an initial dialogue with Phil. And by the top of the hour, we'll roll into a Q&A and circle of sharing, where we invite all of your reflections and questions. And I'm going to turn it over to you now, Richard. Thank you for being here. And please introduce Phil and roll us right into the call.
Thank you so much, Amit. Well, I think you all have read this wonderful little bio on Phil. I'm going to read a condensed version of that. For the past two decades, Phil Kass has put into practice methods of leadership in his community, Columbus, Ohio, where people are enabled to come up with something they could not have done alone. He's moved beyond a top-down model of leading in favor of creating a conversational space in which collective intelligence can emerge, leading to wiser and more effective action. During Phil's 16-year tenure as CEO of four affiliated not-for-profit health corporations, he implemented this model of leadership. His experiments later led to the creation of a countywide multi-stakeholder initiative aimed at enabling the current health system to function more effectively. This transformational form of leadership under Phil's influence has continued to spread into other institutions in Columbus and even to a federal initiative on homelessness. Dr. Kass's shift is His shift in how he engages as a leader was inspired by his experiences at the Shambhala Institute during a conference he attended in 2002. At that conference, a process called the Art of Hosting was being demonstrated. So we're going to want to learn about all of this, Phil, but I know that all of this sort of represents a shift that took place in your life after a long process of work and evolution. So I'd like to invite you to share something of the story of how you got to where this pivotal shift took place in your life. So maybe you could tell us a little bit. I don't know if you want to go back as far as childhood or not. I mean, there's always important material there. But would you share with us something about your evolution?
Thank you, Richard, and thanks for the privilege to be on this call and to have the opportunity to tell a story. It's quite an honoring thing to have your story asked about, so thank you. So I can just simply say something simple about my upbringing. I'm pretty average. I think you'd find it hard to probably find a more average Midwestern white guy. I was born in St. Louis and moved around a bit as a kid to parents who were wonderful, and we were not remarkable. I don't know that I'm remarkable now, but I think I just want to paint a picture of just a regular Midwestern upbringing, and that was me. Fast forward, I think probably one of the things that's true about me is I think my career and my work has always been pretty instinctual. I don't think I ever really formally applied for a job until I was in my early 50s. I think they were things that I could sense along the way and people I knew and then were invited in. So, started out as a high school. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Started out as a high school basketball coach and a high school guidance counselor at inner-city parochial high school in New Haven, Connecticut, and had a critical decision I had to make to either remain as in a coaching high school coaching role, which I loved and could have seen a future for myself in coaching, or go back to school and further my education. And so in 1977, I left New Haven, Connecticut, and came to Columbus, Ohio, and did my PhD in counseling, and finished that in 1981. I think of significance in there is my marriage and the birth of my two daughters, who were then and remain very core in my life. What I think is also significant was in 1981, while I was 2 years into holding, besides the guidance counseling job I had in New Haven, I now was finishing my PhD and was working in a professional's role as a therapist in a mental health center. And in 1981, the day, literally the morning, I graduated in the morning in September with my PhD from Ohio State, and that afternoon was on the operating table, having been diagnosed with testicular cancer. So wow. Literally the same day.
Oh, my gosh.
And I tell that just simply because it probably the the birth of my children and the fact that I was diagnosed at 32 with cancer was quite formative to the rest of my life.
Wow.
I quickly understood life as impermanent. I quickly understood that given that it was impermanent, whatever was going to happen needed to happen in a way that I made choices to live fully. And at 32, when you're diagnosed with cancer, you know, I meet people now who are diagnosed with cancer later in their life, and they have a more reflective view, a more mature view of what being diagnosed with a potentially terminal illness does to them. For me, at 32 years old, it meant turn the throttle up, not down. It meant doing as much as I could do before it might end.
Mm-hmm.
And so I became much more an active person as opposed to a reflective person in a lot of ways.
Well, at that point, having just gotten your PhD and becoming more active, what exactly were the first sort of engagements with the world, so to speak? I mean, did you? I think you said you were already working at a counseling center.
It's a great question. It's kind of a funny question in a lot of ways. my doctoral dissertation was on burnout and stress, ironically. Mm-hmm. And literally while I was in the hospital, I they did an 8-hour surgery, and the nurses on that oncology floor were so sensitive to the fact that I was 32. I just finished my PhD. They knew that, you know, at that time, that disease was not what it is today. It was, you know, more lethal. And they were just sensitive to the fact that I was experiencing a complete lack of sense of meaning. I mean, my life had been devastated. And so they began to just ask me questions while I was lying in bed about stress, about burnout, about what they could do about it. And I think in a lot of ways, I'm sure they were probably trying to humor me. But as I explained things to them and I talked to them, and I had done a lot of stress workshops, they said, you know, do you think you would be willing to speak to us nurses on the oncology floor?
Oh,
it turned out, so to answer your question, but probably 2 weeks after I was diagnosed, I did, standing in my hospital gown, probably hopefully without my butt hanging out, I did stress workshops for 3 shifts of oncology nurses at Riverside Hospital in Columbus, Ohio.
That's amazing. That is a beautiful story. I love that story. I mean, really, To me, that's a brilliant intervention by the nurses, and thank you for sharing that.
It was a brilliant intervention by the nurses, and I was very grateful for it. Because they were so generous that way, I took it very seriously to do a good job for them. So to your question about how did I get active, I literally was weak enough that I can remember standing up in the nurses' area where I did the education, pretty much shaking on my feet. But it was such a generous offer. I just determined myself that if they were going to offer that, I was going to do the best I could and get through it. So the third shift workshop I did was a little hairy.
Well, that's quite wonderful. Now, you were still working in the mental health center, but and there's probably, of course, there's a lot more to this story going forward, but you mentioned that you didn't apply for a job or try to get a job until you were in your 50s. Was that right? Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah, it's probably a bit of an overstatement. It was true with my guidance counseling job. When I got the job at the mental health center, I did undergo an interview and was accepted. But I proceeded in that role from being a therapist and a educator, mental health educator, into an associate director, and then actually became the executive director. And in those cases, I did not interview for jobs. I was promoted because there were things that were opening, and people thought that I would fill that role well. So within 3 years, I guess, of being employed in that mental health center, I went to become an associate director and then ultimately the executive director of that mental health center. And part of the reason I got the opportunity to be the executive director was because there was an executive director before me that was actually quite fraudulent in his work, and even in the placement of the mental health center. This was back in the Mental Health Center Act days, where we were really supposed to be serving people who had no ability to pay and who were the most vulnerable. And they had sent the mental health center in one of the wealthier parts of town. And so one of the things I did right from the very beginning, I was a brand new executive director, and I told the board at that time this wasn't acceptable. We needed to sell that building, and we needed to move the center into the center of town where people with need really could access us. And so one of my early acts was to move the mental health center into a part of town that would serve people that it was intended to serve.
That's beautiful. You know what it makes me think of? We had a brief conversation yesterday, and I was asking you about your training and your doctorate and so forth, and you told me that Ohio State was sort of home base to Carl Rogers. And I wonder, I imagine you've pondered what you absorbed from Carl Rogers. Somehow this story you told made me think of Carl Rogers and his kind of unconditional positive regard, that principle.
You know, Carl Rogers, not while I was here, but he had been a faculty at Ohio State University, and it did have quite a bit of an influence on the department that I did my PhD in. And in those days, Carl Rogers' teaching and his books and such really did have an impact on me. I think as time had gone on, what I realized is that his philosophy had kind of lost its consciousness for me, but it had been really rooted in my soul in terms of the belief in people and the belief of possibility. So, yes, Carl Rogers did influence how I viewed people, and that has stood the test of time for me. It's been important.
I really had that feeling talking to you. In the brief period we've talked, I really did get that feeling. And so what happened when, I guess you left eventually, you left your role as director of the mental health in place. What happened after that?
Yeah, so I was the director there for 5 years. And in Ohio, we have these things called, alcohol, drug, and mental health boards. And each of the 88 counties either has a mental health board, if you're a large county, and Columbus is, or it's a multi-county board. I was asked by the then president of the Franklin County Alcohol, Drug, and Mental Health Board if I would be willing to join him as a vice president of the board. That role is a role of funding, evaluating, contracting for all of the publicly supported alcohol, drug, and mental health services in the county. So it contracts with over 50 agencies to deliver services, and it's the coordinating body of all the mental health services and alcohol and drug services in the county. So I was asked if I would be willing to consider being the vice president, and it was a great opportunity, and so I said yes to that and left direct service, if you will, in the mental health center, and moved on into that role. And then actually that I was in that role a year when the president left, and so within the next year I was asked if I would consider being the president of that organization. So for 12 and a half years I headed up the organization that oversaw all the planning, funding, and evaluation of publicly supported mental health services and alcohol and drug services for Columbus, Ohio, Franklin County, Ohio. About $106 million budget,
wow.
Tax supported. We had federal resources, state resources, and then in Ohio, these organizations can ask for local taxpayers to tax themselves for those services. And that story is germane, and I'll perhaps get to that. I will get to that in a minute. But in the time that I was in that role, the services for people with serious mental illness were pretty much still operating out of the 1960s model of care for people. And one of the things that I undertook was to rethink care for people with serious mental illness and basically restructure, reinvent services for people with serious mental illness, and did that by being successfully applying for a grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And over those years, literally moved millions of dollars around to create a more responsive system of care for people with serious mental illness.
Oh, my goodness. That.
And also got a three-year grant to address issues of cultural competency. One of the things that became clear to me was while our services need to be reinvented, we also needed to reinvent how culturally we were looking at underserved people and people who of color. And so I also got a three-year grant to undertake a massive training on cultural competency using an Afrocentric model.
This is so interesting to hear about, Phil, to get some of this background and to see what a tremendous sort of basis you must have learned during your 12 and a half years there, dealing with all these different groups of people and agencies and all this money. What an incredible grounding in how things work, and I take it that somewhere you wrote on some notes to us on Service Space that one of your big pivotal moment was when you lost an election and therefore $40 million in potential funding was not made available. Did that come somewhere around the end of this period, or how does that relate?
So in 1995, I was in that role. I had been part of successful levies. That's what we called these elections, was levies. I was part of three successful levy attempts before that. So I was feeling pretty confident, fairly cocky about myself in terms of how those got done.
Uh-huh.
And in 1995, we were on the ballot for some additional money. And things were changing, and I, on the one hand, was recognizing things were changing, and I had pushed the envelope with a lot of the changes we had made in the system. I don't think I recognized, I know I didn't recognize, the level of pushback from some traditional folks about what we had been doing. And in 1995, I was pretty hell-bent on conducting that levy my way, the way I knew, how I thought I knew how these things went. And so we ran that levy in 1995, and we lost in November of 1995. Literally on the first Tuesday of November, with an election, you could be $40 million richer or $40 million poorer.
Wow.
And luckily, I'd gone a year before I was in a situation where I actually would lose $40 million. So we lost. And at that point, I hired a person who is now one of my very best friends, that when I hired him to help me think through the going back to the electorate in 1996, he said to me very candidly, he said, and this was, I thought, part of the reason we're still friends today. He was with me as an employee for a week, and he said to me, if we do this levy and your ego is as involved in this levy as it in 96 as it is now, it will lose again.
Hmm.
And I said to him, and I won't use the words I used on the were on this phone, but I said, you've got to be kidding me. You want me to give up control on this next levy in a more participatory way, and I've got $40 million on the line next year. Hmm. And he said, yeah, if you don't, it's going to go down again. Well, neither of us knew what participatory really meant.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that year, I trusted him, and I said, okay, let's go. And in that year, we began to become participatory in whatever way we knew how. We didn't really have skillful means, but we tried everything we could in terms of involving people.
Yeah. Can you give a couple of examples of what you tried?
Yeah, I can. In 1995, when we made the commercials for TV, it was me and two other people sitting in the TV studio making the commercials.
Mm-hmm.
In 1996, when we made the commercials, we had 25 people sitting in the studio from all walks of the community, giving guidance on how those commercials were made and what they need to say.
Mm.
That's one example.
Yeah, I mean, that must have been a pretty striking experience for you, the difference between those two examples.
Oh, it was. There's nothing short of saying that I was pulling my hair out, thinking, I'm giving up all this control to all these people. I'm going to have to completely trust that there's wisdom here. And this is the tie back to Carl Rogers in a lot of ways.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to have to believe that the outcome of this is going to be better because there's more intelligence here.
Hmm.
And that wasn't something that was easy for me then.
Mm-hmm.
Not on a mass scale. I could do it in a therapeutic context, but when I was working with an entire community and that kind of money, that was a leap of faith for me.
Mm-hmm.
That was not easy. But we won.
Wow.
And in a lot of ways, Richard, where I am today is still an inquiry that I'm in from what happened in 1996.
Oh, I love that. I love that you said that. That it's encouraging to me somehow to know there's still an inquiry because, you know, in a way, once we have the answers, in a way, we're pretty close to getting in trouble, wouldn't you say?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, if there's one of many things I think I've learned over my lifetime, it's the question, not the answer.
How far from this account that you're giving me to the your experience at the Shambhala Institute?
Yeah, so this is 1996. After that levy in 96, I knew that I had to completely rethink my leadership style. And I had to try to start to experiment and learn more about participatory ways of operating. And so between 96 and 99, I tried within the context of the mental health system to reinvent myself. And I found that very difficult for lots of reasons, not the least of which is I had driven huge change in the system. And so what I was understood to be and what I was trying to ultimately become were really a fairly diametrically opposed. So in 99, I decided that the system probably needed me to be gone, and I needed to be gone. And so I looked around, and there literally the building next door to the building that I was in housed the Columbus Medical Association and the other three corporations. And they were looking for a new CEO.
Wow.
So I talked with people because I, at that point in time, you can imagine the kind of role I had been in. I knew lots of people in town. And so mm-hmm. I talked to people on that board, and they were interested in what I had to offer. And after going through, you know, the proper process, I was offered the job to be the CEO of those companies. And I left the Alcohol, Drug, and Mental Health Board in 1999 then and moved over. Between 1999 and 2001, I was still experimenting, but I had a new place to experiment now. I had new staff to experiment with, and I was very candid. I said to folks from the get-go, I have a sense of what this is about. I understand its essence, which is about confidence in people. It's confidence in people's intelligence. It's confident that everyone can participate, but I have no clue how to do this. And so candid.
Wait a minute. I mean, did they, when you were talking, you were approaching this new position, people were there already who were sort of had this a view of how to bring other people together and respect them and make them part of decisions and all that? Is that what you're is that?
Actually, I was entering an organization that had been run by somebody that was a virtual dictator.
I see. Okay.
And they knew that they needed something different.
Ah, okay.
And so I absolutely believe that it was because of that dichotomy that they were open to taking on this guy who was saying that these are the principles and I don't have the means.
I see. Okay.
I think it was that dichotomous that they were willing to take that risk with me.
Oh, that's very interesting. Okay, that's very clear.
Yeah, so between 99 and 2001, I was literally, we would do things like read together some of Margaret Wheatley's work on self-organizing systems. I had some of her tapes. We were reading other authors. We were together trying to understand what self-organizing meant, what being a collective meant. But again, I really didn't have good, skillful means. And then it was in 2001 that I went to the Shambhala Institute. And I went there because Margaret Wheatley was going to be speaking there, and I would have a chance to spend a week with her.
Uh-huh.
So I went there to spend a week with her. And Meg is now a dear friend over the years. She's become a very dear friend. In fact, I've been the chair of the Berkana board for several years with her. But, yeah, I went to spend time with her that week. And while I was there, I met a woman by the name of Juanita Brown, who is the founder of the World Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started thinking, oh, my God, there is actually skills here that I don't know anything about that I can potentially use within the context of what we're trying to do at the Medical Association.
Hmm.
Went back in 92 and thinking I'd spend the time with Juanita, and she was doing something else, and there was an art of hosting training, one of the first art of hosting trainings that had been done by a dear friend of mine from Denmark, and a young woman from Africa. And that was the beginning of my experience with the art of hosting, was actually in 2002.
Now, that was pivotal, right?
It was absolutely pivotal in that I finally started to see skillful means that could be used that were in sync with my underlying, both emerging and old and emerging sense of people's potential. And it's been from all of that that I really worked with staff at remaking the culture of the Medical Association and their affiliate corporations into a highly participatory culture. I've said to people, and it's true, our leadership team of eight of us met in circle every week for 16 years.
Okay, so this shift really became kind of, in a way, clear and specific and supported. Was it like 16 years ago or something like that?
Yeah, it goes back to 2003.
Okay.
Yep.
So the circle that you're talking about is the circle of your lead, of the sort of responsible people in the organizations.
That is what it is, but also circle itself, the form, is a social technology.
Okay.
One can learn how to host a circle as a methodology for hosting the intelligence of a group of people. And so when I talk about circle, I'm actually talking about a form that has methodology to it,
mm-hmm.
that has practice to it,
mm-hmm.
Just like the World Cafe, just like Open Space, just like a lot of social technologies that are participatory. We incorporated all of those, but we were small enough that the circle, the methodology of circle, became the operating system of our organization for those years.
So... So you have been, and I'm not exactly clear whether you still are, but you were the CEO of four sort of health related corporations, not-for-profit corporations, and were you at that time? Are you still in those roles or not?
So in 2016. I decided I was at that time. I'm going on 70 now. I was, 67. I decided that time for somebody else to come in, and it was time for me to free myself of some of the things that I was doing there and move on. While I was at the Medical Association, I spent 2 years with Otto Scharmer as well, and I saw that. I think he's been a person you've interviewed. I spent 2 years with Otto Scharmer in Cambridge in a master class with him, learning a lot about Theory U. And so one of the things that we did was we undertook to understand the soul of physicians at a level that I don't think had ever been done before. And so we did 50 very deep two-hour interviews with 50 physicians across the community to try to understand what is really going on with physicians.
Oh.
And we came away from that
wow.
pretty shocked. The literature is replete now with...
Yeah, what was shocking?
Yeah. Physicians have now become the number one group of people that commit suicide in the United States.
Oh, my gosh.
Up to 60% of... Some studies have shown that up to 69% of physicians are depressed.
Hmm.
In those interviews, we... had people tell us more than once that they had attempted suicide.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
And so we decided then that there were things that we needed to do and as an organization, and so we did some things to change it. But what we did I didn't think was sufficient, and so at the end of my time there, I decided with the help and support of the boards, we founded a mindfulness-based physician leadership program. And so today I'm the co-director of that. We're in our fifth year, our fifth cohort. When this group graduates at the end of the 10-month program, we'll have 80 meditating physicians in Columbus.
Wow. Well,
yeah.
Well, as I'm listening to you, I'm just feeling some kind of hope about what you've learned and what you're bringing to healthcare, because I'm not a student of this, but I think many of us sort of intuitively recognize that healthcare in the U.S. is just in a terrible shape. Do you have any general reflections you'd like to make about the general state of our healthcare in the U.S.?
Well, in fact, I would say, and there's a big project, Richard, that we've left out that reflects on that. So we got invested in the issue of healthcare for the uninsured and created a literal and virtual free clinic for people in town. We have over 1,000 physicians who volunteer in it.
1,000?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. That reflects a kind of the deep reasons why people become doctors.
It does. And that's why we did it. That's part of the reason we did it. It was for people who were uninsured, but it was also for physicians.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We also launched then a community initiative to try to understand what the community wanted from health care. Nobody had asked the community.
Mm-hmm.
The healthcare system's grown up topsy-turvy.
Yeah.
And so we set out to ask the community what it wanted out of its healthcare system. And so we, again, went out and conducted interviews with CEOs of businesses, with insurance companies, with citizens, with folks, and tried to ascertain whether this community was ready to do something. And we came back saying we think so. And so then we sponsored 10 community assemblies using a lot of this art of hosting methodology that I just spoke of,
mm-hmm.
to engage over 1,000 citizens in what the purpose of healthcare is in our community. And it was from those 10 assemblies that we learned that the citizens did not want just a sick care system. They wanted a health care system,
mm-hmm.
and wanted to see changes in the health care system that were in that orientation. So one of the outcomes of that work was that now another good friend of mine, who also is an art of hosting practitioner, and was the CEO of a not-for-profit organization, they took it on to see if they could shift how healthcare was being delivered in Columbus. And so, again, with no authority, they're not a government entity, they're a not-for-profit, using the hosting methodologies, brought together insurers and providers and hospitals and what have you. And today, there are over 500,000 people in Columbus, and Columbus is about 1.1 million. There are 500,000 people in Columbus are getting their primary care in something called patient-centered medical homes, which are health-oriented primary care.
What does that mean? Tell us about what a patient-centered medical home is, and what does it look like? How does it work?
It's oriented toward, of course, taking care of illness, but it's oriented toward, one, making sure that it is organized in a way that it has all the services it needs. So, for instance, a patient-centered medical home will typically have personal relationship with psychologists, personal relationship with social workers, personal relationship with local food bank, personal relationship with community resources, so that when the patient comes in, it's not just my fever and my cold, but are you eating right? Are you depressed? So it's a comprehensive approach to healthcare. And it's the expectation that a patient-centered medical home will have gathered the resources together so it can easily both make referrals but more importantly, identify the fact that healthcare is multifactorial, and in bringing the resources together, understand that they need to be able to access those resources if people are going to really be healthy. It's more complicated than that, Richard, but that's kind of the basics of a patient-centered medical home.
Okay. Now, when I read that phrase, I sort of imagined like a three-bedroom house.
Well, it's not an accident that it's called a medical home.
Mm-hmm.
For, I mean, it is really the intention that people will see that point, medical home access point, as home for getting healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, so do people live there while they're sick? I guess that's not a
no.
Place for
it's not
to
a
live.
It's not a physical living space. It's simply that, and I go to a patient-centered medical home. When I go there, and I'll get emails from the doctor saying, it's time for this, it's time for that. You need to have this checkup. You need to have that blood work. So they're proactive about my health. They will ask me things. You know, physicians' practices are well known for not dealing with the obvious. Overweight, don't exercise. They address that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
Now, with people who I'm privileged. I don't have the disadvantages that many people have in terms of economics and that sort of thing. But in the clinics within the city, all of the things around food, around housing, around domestic violence. Well, my practice always asks me, "Do you feel safe at home?"
Mm.
So that's wow. addressed no matter where you are.
So a patient-centered medical home might look like a hospital.
Might look like a doctor's office.
I see. Okay.
And they've just simply added all these components to it, including most patient-centered medical homes have same-day access, meaning that in Columbus, as I said, 500,000 people are in patient-centered medical homes. They can typically access health care today if they're sick today, as opposed to having to go to the emergency room.
Does this work to the doctors who are staff in these medical homes? Do you think the way it's organized helps them feel better about their practice? Are they able to spend any more time with a person that comes in? How would you describe that?
I think, you know, when it first gets implemented, when patient-centered medical home first gets implemented practice, it's actually just the opposite. I think physicians feel fairly overwhelmed by it. But once they kind of get it and are able to start to work with it, and what we've also worked on is changing the financing for primary care so that much of the financing now is what we term value-based as opposed to event-based, there is now more time for physicians to see patients. And that's very satisfying to physicians. I can tell you from working with physicians for 16 years, one of the biggest things that they struggle with is not being able to see patients for a time that is both good for the patient and good for them. It creates a moral dilemma for them.
Yeah, yeah.
When a physician has to see 35 patients in a day, they leave at the end of the day not only physically exhausted and mentally exhausted, they're morally exhausted because they know in their heart they could not do
wow.
what they know they are trained to do.
How does how do you deal with the realities of the insurance industry in terms of managing the financial end of health care?
Yeah, it's been interesting. We have been successful at bringing the major insurers together here, that in the beginning we just asked them if they would, because we started, this grew over the course of 10 years. We asked them originally if they would just do pilot projects with a few practices and change their funding focus to experiment to see if it actually delivered better for them. And it did, and so here in Columbus, we've had some major shifts in how insurers are paying for primary care that is more along this value-based strain that I'm talking about than fee-for-service. We're getting into some really complicated financial stuff here, but insurers were willing to experiment when they weren't, and that was the beauty of the participatory process. There was no government forcing them into it.
Mm-hmm.
They were part of they sat with hospitals, they sat with primary care physicians, they sat with patients, and together talk through what some of these experiments might look like.
So have you been part of these? I'm assuming you have been part of these discussions and with people from the insurance companies and maybe some larger stakeholders that aren't based in Columbus, Ohio, per se. Are you able to initiate in any way some of these principles that you've learned from the art of hosting in such meetings?
All those meetings were based on those principles.
And
it wasn't me that was hosting them. There was another fellow that is a good friend of mine who'd gone. When I brought this art of hosting training back to Columbus.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you have, say, Prudential or Blue Shield or somebody, a national insurer, are you able to have somebody from Blue Shield
yes.
be part of such a circle?
Yes.
Or?
Yes.
Yes.
We were able to have the national insurers in a conversation.
What's your take on the impression that's being made on people that, in your direct experience?
You know, at first, like anything, insurers were some of the most cynical.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But when they were also faced in those meetings with business executives who, quite frankly, were confused themselves mm-hmm. about what they were buying in insurance and even confused about healthcare. But once those conversations would start and businesses started to say to the insurers, if you're not in this game, we got to figure out somebody else. So it was really businesses when they started to wake up to what was happening in their own world of buying healthcare, they are the ones that began to put pressure on the insurance companies to say, well, we got to try something different here.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was the combination of citizens and hospitals and providers and businesses together with government. The county government said, you know, we're not going to continue to pay the way and buy the way we've been buying. So come to the table and try something different with us.
It sounds to me like what you're describing is a possible lever of influence. And I want you to reflect on the difference between not-for-profit organizations and for-profit organizations. And it seems like the for-profit model, I mean, things that I read in here is, when it's the bottom line for a bunch of stakeholders in the corporation, the for-profit corporation, there's just like that whole corporate model is like, well, we're just serving our shareholders and forget the rest of society.
So, Richard, this is, I think, a good, you know, when you talk about what this call is supposed to be about, I'd like to just simply say this. Yes, for-profit and not-for-profit does have something to do with it, but what really has to do with it is what is the heart and soul of the leadership
mm-hmm.
that's, in this case, convening these conversations.
Mm-hmm.
We had a group of people who had absolutely no agenda other than creating the common good.
Mm.
And I don't know enough to know whether if they had been coming from a for-profit standpoint or that happened to be a not-for-profit,
mm-hmm.
how that would have played out. I'm sure it would have been different. But it was really in a lot of this work with patient-centered medical homes, with shifting the healthcare system, with the work I did within my own organization, that I really started to understand at a fundamental level, this is about relationships between people. This is about whether you really care,
mm-hmm.
and whether you're willing to live that out and push it.
That sounds very powerful to me, and as I listen to you speak, I feel that in people's heart of hearts, that's what they long for, is relationship. And yet, there's a quote, and I think it was maybe from Margaret Wheatley, and it's the quote, I'm looking for it, but it's something like this. I used to think that a good idea, well presented, could change the world. I was still innocent.
Yeah. But I do think that a good heart and a strong heart and a real heart, well positioned, I don't know if it can change the world, but I know it can change the world around you.
Mm. And, you
and that was the basis for the founding of the Physician Leadership Academy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We've just recently, Richard, defined for ourselves what leadership is.
Hmm.
And our definition, the Physician Leadership Academy in Columbus, Ohio's definition of leadership is caring deeply about something, deciding to act on that caring, and then acting out from that place of caring in the form of what we do as leadership. Then there is a requirement of skillful means. we teach meditation because we teach it as the way we've defined it as it's a radical act of self-caring. So we have to help the physicians rediscover caring for themselves. We have to help physicians rediscover allowing other people to care for them. Because just simply caring for patients and not caring for yourself and not allowing yourself to be cared for is sure track for dying in one form or another.
Yeah. I'm interested in this phrase, skillful means, that you're using. And I have questions about that because I have a little experience, not very much, but enough to know that when you bring people together, you can't be sure that you don't have a few people in there that are going to be difficult. They're going to talk too much. They can't hear other people maybe, or there's competition, kind of ego issues. This is very difficult when you bring people together. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I would absolutely agree, and my experience has certainly been that. I've been faced with, I can't even tell you how many times I've been faced with people who wanted to stop everything I was doing cold in their tracks. Yeah?
Yeah. What are the skillful means? I mean, can you give some examples or some stories where...
So here I am. I'm in the midst of trying to change a law in the state of Ohio where physicians have to notify patients if they leave their practice and retire or go out of town. They have to give them a notice. And as hospitals had taken on more and more hiring of physicians, there was nothing in the law that required hospitals to do that. And in our community, I found out that a hospital had fired 15 physicians, and the notice to patients was tacked on the door.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
So I went to the legislature, and we are the capital here, and I got a legislator to draft a bill to change that law to make hospitals conform to notice just like physicians do. And they saw it as costly and bureaucratic, and they were doing it already. They really didn't need to do it. And we were coming down to a vote on the bill, and the legislator invited me to a meeting that I thought I was going to with two lobbyists from the hospital association and myself and the legislator. Mm-hmm. When I walked into the room, I was faced with 25 lobbyists from all across the state of Ohio who were all there who were wanting to hang me up, and the legislator. And in the course of the conversation, I was clearly losing that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to myself, I'm going to have to go to another level. This conversation's got to drop into another level of conversation. And so I looked at them and I said, guys, I know what's going on here. I'm not stupid. I've been around for a long time. But I'm going to ask you this. Everybody in this room is a patient. Everyone in this room is a patient. I would like any of you in this room who find it okay, it would be okay if you found that your physician had left town by a note on the door. If that's okay with you and you feel like you could live with that, put your hand up. And the room got quiet. And then somebody spoke up and said, okay, Phil, what do we have to do to get this done?
Oh, that's beautiful.
It required a different conversation. It required a different level of conversation. And so often where I think I was in that moment thinking, these guys are going to think I'm a complete fool. I'm either going to get laughed out of this room or it's going to work. But I had to take that risk because I was losing. And I tried to figure out how to take the conversation and deepen it, and it worked.
It's encouraging because you made an appeal to people's essential humanity.
Yeah. Is this okay with you? Is it okay with you?
Yeah.
To find that you lost your doctor by a note on the door.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
So we have a law in Ohio that doesn't allow that anymore.
Amit, what do you think? This has been so far just a great and wonderful conversation.
Absolutely, this is fantastic. I do want to
open it up to the callers that are listening in via the webcast or that have dialed in, that if you do have a question, go ahead. You can go ahead and push star six now, and then we'll put you into the queue to ask a question, or you can always submit something via the webcast form or an email to ask@servicespace.org. I would love to just kind of continue this dialogue. I mean, you know, one of the things that was interesting is, you know, and you may have covered it briefly early on the call, but we keep coming back to this concept of skillful means. And I know that word means, it can mean a lot of things to different people. And so I was hoping that you could maybe break that down for us. What does that mean really for you? And how does one truly develop those skillful means? I mean, when you're in a room like that with so many different opinions and minds and bringing that together, there's a manner in which you can approach it. And there's also, skillful means can be also used to, you know, how you approach problems internally within yourself. And so, you know, I'm curious how you came across that and how you've learned it and developed it, the discipline around it.
I think I first started to understand it about in the context of truth telling. You know, as a trained therapist, we learned and we understand that having people speak what's in their mind and in their heart is often a helpful therapeutic process. We also know that when people do that as a way of unloading in a therapeutic process, that's helpful. Unloading in a public process oftentimes is not. So how do we skillfully tell our truth? And so for me, one of the things that I began to work with myself was not allowing myself to get away with being comfortable in telling my truth in a way that was a battering ram, which is how I led the alcohol and drug addiction system for a number of years. I tell the truth, this system stinks and we got to make it different and this is where we're going to go. To understanding that in fact the people that I'm speaking to have the same truth, the same capacity to care about people. And how do I tell my truth in a way that becomes an invitation as opposed to a battering ram for people to consider thinking about something different? And so personally for me, this notion of how do I tell my truth skillfully such that it's usable, where someone else can they actually hear it, decide whether they want to work with it or not, but at least it's come from my heart to them as a gift as opposed to something that was actually an attempt to just unload and potentially be harmful. And so I think from that basis, then you start to talk about how do we collectively tell our truth? How do we collectively engage people in a way that is productive truth-telling that actually gets us someplace, not only in terms of decisions and processes and institutions, but gets it, but fundamentally, you know, in these processes, what we're really doing is building relationships. Institutions will come and go. God only knows I know that from the times and years I've spent working with systems change. But what stays is relationships. And so in the form of working around systems change, using processes that encourage people to tell their truth in a skillful way creates a long-term possibility that's not built on the impermanence of institutions, but is built on the back of real relationships. People who know me know that I'm fond of saying that a few years ago I adopted a goal of falling in love with as many people as I can before I die. And I say that because that's the basis, you know? that's the only thing that's that lasts. So, I hope that helps to answer your question a bit. But that's how I came to it, was working with my own truth and how to work with that. And yeah,
it's a beautiful framing and a wonderful paradigm. And I think oftentimes, you know, when I'm thinking about, you know, conversations in groups and circles and, you know, in the leadership context, you know, so often when people are speaking their truth, but perhaps not so skillfully, people end up becoming defensive and closed up. And when you're approaching it from this mindset of openness, truth, and from the heart, and in the space of love, it's received so much more differently. That was beautiful. Thank you for answering that.
You know, and I think you know, along the way here for me, there was personal exploration, personal learning. Art of Hosting really helped, and then came along Otto Scharmer, and Otto Scharmer starts talking about the blind spot of our time is who. We've spent billions and billions of dollars on reinventing process to get better results, and the blind spot of our times has been, what's the interior condition of the intervener? Who's doing the intervention? And from what place are they coming from? If they're coming for system change because they're pissed off and hateful, guess what you're going to get? If you come from systems change from the standpoint of, you know, people are confused, but they're basically good people, we got to engage that goodness, you get a different result. So Otto, in a lot of ways for me, in the time I spent with him, really, both theoretically and in practice, helped to, in a sense, codify my deeper beliefs about how these things work.
I'm curious about the impact, you know, this leadership style has had on some of your other team members, you know, and whether it's or even individuals in the community, have they begun to implement this style, this approach, even just, you know, having circles within their own various organizations?
So we've ended up training about 1,200 leaders in Columbus now in Art of Hosting. And
wow.
So I do find there are places now, I'll go to a church meeting someplace, I'll go to a community meeting someplace, and I'll walk into a World Cafe, or I'll walk into a circle, or what have you. Are we a tipping point? Probably not. Have we had an impact in terms of how the dialogue is happening? Yes, we have. There are several departments at Ohio State University that have begun to work this way. There are several corporations in Columbus that have begun to work this way. So, yeah, it's had an impact. I now, part of the training that the physicians who go through our academy, not only do they learn meditation, but they learn how to host conversations. They're learning how to host their patients.
You know, I'll tell you from my own personal experience, you know, my father was a physician, my younger brother's a physician, and while they are great at taking care of others, yes, and very much in line with everything that you've seen and observed and managed over time, terrible at sometimes at self-care. And they can just across the board, I've always felt like doctors can sometimes be the worst patients in that sense, because you know, while they're first in line to care for others, coming back to themselves. And so I'm curious, you know, while, you know, offering these wonderful programs, and how do you make that internal shift in them? What, you know, was there something that's different about the makeup of a physician to have it click that, you know, yes, I need to do some self-care, or create that openness towards, say, you know, the learning meditation or any of the other things that you teach in your program?
You know what's even harder for physicians than caring for themselves is allowing other people to care for them.
Mm.
And when we point out to physicians that that's the hardest lesson for them to learn, but it's the lesson that they expect their patient, every time they walk into their office, they expect their patient to be compliant with allowing themselves to be cared for by them, And then we say to them, how can that possibly happen if you know nothing about that yourself? And then we offer, here's some ways of communicating, here's some ways of being quiet and seeing yourself and starting to really like yourself. Here's some skillful ways of doing that. And we do it over 10 months. I knew one workshop or that wasn't going to cut it. So it's a repetitive process, just like meditation is a repetitive process. Learn it. So every time they come together, each month, they sit in circle. They're practicing meditation. They're reminded of the self-care, and they're reminded of what's more important. Actually, it's not more important, but as important is developing the capacity to allow yourself to be cared for. We all have trouble with that one.
Yeah.
But it's a skill. It's part of what, if you're going to care for other people and you don't know how to allow yourself to be taken care of, then we can't know what the experience of our patient is.
Hmm.
They have the doubt and fear is at the basis of why we struggle with allowing ourselves to be cared for. That's what patients are walking in with, doubt and fear at a magnitude level. Because there could be something really wrong here.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's interesting hearing this, and I'm curious, you know, with all these insights that you've developed, you know, if you were to go back to your 32-year-old self after you had just been diagnosed, I'm curious how you would have coached yourself or walked yourself through hearing the impact of having cancer at 32.
That's a great question. You know, I think that's what I'm doing now. I think it's part of what I'm in this phase of my life that I'm spending time with myself now on those very questions that at 32 I couldn't have been in. But yeah. I think that's absolutely part of my path now.
It's beautiful.
You know,
go ahead, Richard. Sorry.
I'm heartened to hear that you're very clear about the need for work, so to speak. That these things are not developed over a weekend, there's a deliberateness that's required over time, a kind of practice and an aim. And this isn't like a freebie exactly. It really requires something. So would you say more about that?
I guess, you know, I would just simply say there's been something inside of me that's known for a really long time that short-term kind of interventions can have an effect, but really don't shift the person, shift systems. I think, you know, years ago, there were people that, when I finished my PhD, I think about, there were people who wanted me to go an academic route, who wanted me to do the workshop route. They saw, you know, the possibility of this is how I could make money and I could make impact in terms of teaching classes and that sort of thing. And I said to them at the time, I said, you know, I really need to go work. I need to go work in institutions and organizations over a period of years to understand what work life is really like for most people in this country. It's not the stuff that we as academics think it is. It's tough. I worked in factories when I was a kid, when I was in high school. I saw what that was. I saw what real work was. And so in a lot of ways, I'm sorry to be belaboring this, but for me, it goes back to that. It goes back to learning that, in fact, daily lives are lived day by day and most of the time and through monotony.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we become what we can potentially become in real life, living day to day, in the monotony sometimes of producing every day? And I know now, you know, I know that that takes time and it takes effort and it takes practice.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen fast.
Yeah, yeah.
I hope that was a fair enough answer for you.
It has the ring of truth to my ear. And I have this thought, and I wonder what your reflections might be around it. I mean, a new model of leadership that you're talking about, this use of skillful means and the way of fostering relationship and getting through assumptions and so forth, getting to a real relationship, it still requires a leader or someone that has the skillful means and has the knowledge and knows what it really is and knows when it isn't happening and how to keep an eye on where it needs to go. And I can't help but think that this is like having a real father or a real mother. Does that make any sense to you?
Well, I certainly think I think those of us who have been fortunate enough to have those experiences growing up, absolutely. I think I think the vast majority of people don't have that experience, and so they've got to still learn.
Yeah, I mean, in other cultures, I mean, you may know better, but there's Gandhiji and Auntie and father, and it's part of the culture that other people who one feels something from one's heart towards are addressed as brother, sister, mother, father. It's not just my nuclear family. I think there's a deep wisdom in that. What do you think?
I do. I think absolutely that's the case. But I also think that the essence of that is already there in we as human beings. You know, I've said to people a lot of times, I think that my purpose in life now, probably until now and when I pass, is really to try to help people remember what is already essentially inside of them.
Mm-hmm.
I got an email from a young physician who was in our academy last year, who was one of the people I coached. And I kept the email because it brings me to tears every time I read it. He talks about a situation in which he had a very complex situation with a patient, and he could not figure out the diagnosis, and in fact missed the diagnosis, was careful enough because he sensed that he might be missing it, that he sent him to a specialist who he thought might nail it, and they did. And so the patient came back to him for his follow-up visit, and the physician that I had coached was completely ready to apologize and bare his soul about what he knew and didn't know. Which that alone is an amazing thing.
Mm-hmm.
For a physician, and so healthy for him. When he started that, the patient said, "You don't need to do that. I know who you are."
Mm.
And began to teach the physician about what his experience was.
Wow.
And the physician said, "We connected as people. He's not my patient anymore."
Hmm.
Technically he is. But that's not our relationship anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Very powerful.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what he connected to, what the patient connected in him, was his essential humanness, his goodness, and what he connected in the patient was the same thing. And when that happens, that's it.
This is a key. This is a key thing, isn't it?
It is to me.
Well, there's a quote here, our company is based on friendship. In many ways, authentic relationship is our business model. I think that might be a quote from you, according to the bio. So that's what's being said here.
Yep.
You know, actually, one thing that sort of struck me earlier, it was something that you had sort of mentioned. I don't know if it was meant in passing, but you had said that you want to fall in love with as many people as you can in your lifetime. And so, you know, certainly a beautiful sentiment. I'm just wondering if there was a story or an epiphany around that and kind of why you have that goal.
You know, so you guys are pretty good at knowing where there are stories. You know that? So we've been working in this circle for probably 10, 12 years, and one of the people who'd been in that circle with us all those years had a chance to take a great new job in the community, and as much as she loved working with us, it was her time to go, and she needed to do that, and we all knew it. And And so we did our circle goodbyes and we did all that, and I happened to be in the office that night when it was her last night, and she was packing up her books and I helped her pack her car and all that kind of stuff. And as I was driving home that evening, I began to sob so hard that I had to pull off the road because I couldn't see. And I realized while I was sitting there in my car that my heart was breaking. By the time I got home, I began to theorize that this is exactly why we don't work the way we could, because it inevitably, if you work this way, if you love people that way, and I mean that in the most healthy sense of love, you will get brokenhearted. People die, people leave, things change. That's the risk. That's the other side of loving people that you work with, is that you're going to be brokenhearted. And I also decided that night I would never work any other way.
That's really living, I think.
Yeah, you know, it's like I'm not going to live numb. Not going to happen. So, yep, there's a story behind that.
Oh, it's truly, truly beautiful. I have a question here from Jay here in Washington, D.C., and, you know, he asks, so how does this outlook, how does it work with your own family? You know, as you've transformed over the years, how has this outlook worked with communicating and working through things, you know, with your own family, whether it's your wife, kids, anything like that, of that nature?
You know, that's... That's a good question. I think you'd have to ask them. I think it's actually probably the hardest, the closer the people are to you. Mm. It's one thing to talk about a broken heart with a wonderful person who I care a lot about as an employee. I start to talk about my children or my wife or something like that. It gets into a territory that when you talk about loss and pain, I mean, that's what I learned when I had the cancer. I kind of looked at death and I said, you know, I don't think that scares me. It's where the pain is in these relationships. So my answer to your question is I probably am not as skilled, with the people I'm closest to.
Yeah, it could be
tough.
Yeah,
on the other hand, I just know how deep the heart is about that, and I do the best I can.
That's great. So, you know, one of the things that I've always found interesting is that, with the purpose of these calls and, hearing so much, the work that you've been doing, both your own inner work as well as the work with the community, truly inspiring, and I'm so happy that we've been able to sort of shine a light on it. And I'm curious, if you had a minute to sort of share, who's inspiring you today? Where would you like to shine that light?
I think there certainly been people who I've learned from in a powerful way in the classic sense of learned. Meg had a big influence on me in terms of her thinking. Otto's had a big influence on me in terms of his thinking. A friend of mine in Denmark, Toke Muller is his name, has had a huge influence on me. The people who are having the biggest influence on me now tend to be people like my meditation instructor, the woman who teaches meditation for us at the Leadership Academy, this physician who sent me that email. There's not a particular person or theoretician or right now, I am very fond of the writing of Thomas Merton, who, if you're not familiar with his work, he was a monastic priest that lived his life at the Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky, and I go there on retreat. I am particularly inspired by a lot of the Shambhala Buddhist teachings. So I think when I said earlier that part of what my path is right now is really I find myself finally taking the time to deepen my own spiritual path in a way that I'm more intentional about now. So, if I had to name names, Merton and some of the Buddhist teachers, but it's the people in my everyday life. It's them. I said this in the little bio, and I'm not being facetious about this, and I'm not trying to be cute about this, but I have a 6-year-old granddaughter that floors me. when she was born, all the years, those of us who were trained as therapists, Carl Roger, we were trained and learned to do the best we could to provide and be there in terms of unconditional love. And I remember the morning she was born, and I went to see her, and I was like, oh, there it is. There it is. And there's nothing I have to do about it. It's right there. I honestly, she inspires me.
Well, there's something very pure there.
It's a grandparent thing, If you're not in that situation now, look forward to it if you get a chance.
Oh, that's wonderful.
In fact, I'm probably going to go this afternoon and watch The Grinch That Stole Christmas with her. I think that's what we're doing this afternoon.
Phil, as a community, what can we do to be of service to you?
I guess it's what you're doing. I think these interviews. It's when I said at the very beginning that to ask to be interviewed by other human beings, for another human being to ask another human being to tell your story, and to do that in a thorough and honorable way, what a gift that is.
Mm.
This hour and a half that you've given me has been a gift. So I have to think more about it, but I can just simply say that when one asks somebody to tell their story, you're giving big gifts to people, and I appreciate your willingness to ask me to be part of that.
It's a gift that goes in both directions.
It's the only way the real gifts work,
Yeah.
thank you. I appreciate that framing, and you know, it's a thank you really to even all our callers that are listening in that dial in each and every week, because they really do help co-create this space, and you know, and they, you know, we feel like we hold one another to be able to have great conversations like this. So, so thank you to them, and thank you to you, Phil. This has been great. I mean, there's so many beautiful nuggets of wisdom that have sort of come up from the call for me. And you know, the one thing I know I want to walk away from is just, at least even just today, you know, oftentimes when you hear from someone that's an inspirational, and you feel moved, oh, I'm going to make all these changes. But, you know, sometimes I like to just focus it to, well, at least let me see what I can do today, and then start from there. And
that's the only thing we can do. Sometimes yeah. The best thing we can do is just sit there and be quiet.
So, yeah, that's true. So I'm gonna go out there and I'm gonna focus on who I can fall in love with today. So.
Yeah, that's a great practice, let me tell you.
So thank you, really do appreciate it. And Richard, thank you so much. Beautiful, masterful job of moderating the conversation.
Well, thank you, Phil, so much. Thank you, Amit.
You're welcome, and thank you both. And whoever is out there listening, I'm.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.